Okay. Framing the good in postmodernity or high modernity or the contemporary period, of course, is no easy task, and it's been made complicated by a number of key institutional developments. And I'm just going to talk about two of them that have preoccupied contemporary sociologists of modernity. One is broadly called deinstitutionalization or detraditionalization or desocialization, and the other is called compulsory individualization. And both of these issues have immensely complicated the process by which young people engage in the process of forming a vision of the self, a sense of a good life, a sense of self even. And I'm going to just kind of briefly talk about these two. The first is the process of deinstitutionalization. Now, by this, sociologists of modernity mean that over the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a progressive decoupling of individuals from traditional institutions, from values, from norms, from identities, from attachments. And so you get this progressive separation of individuals, individual selves, from traditional social supports or social structures, whether they be families, class, communities, whatever. So you get this kind of progressive deinstitutionalization of individual lives. And that's resulted in the fact that as kids begin to form a conception of what a good life would be for them, what it would mean, what does it mean to have a life that's valuable and rewarding to themselves, they are progressively required. Indeed, the term is often used to talk about compulsory individualization, are progressively required to rely on their own resources, their own judgments, their own understandings, in order to do that, and progressively less on traditional values or norms or attachments. Now, that creates a great deal of anxiety among parents and social commentators because people worry the kids are deracinated, they're alienated, they don't have a clear sense of direction or sense of what a life is about. And that's reflected in the various constructions of the self in modernity that sociologists and psychologists have prepared. And we can see some of these here. I've listed some of these you'd be familiar with. The one that I'm going to just talk about is a quote from Kevin MacDonald, who's a sociologist in Melbourne, University of Melbourne, who did a study of Western Melbourne in the late 90s. And it's a study of a group of Vietnamese, Cambodian and Aboriginal kids, late adolescents. The book is called Struggle for Subjectivity, and it's an amazing kind of story, powerful story, about how these kids were struggling to understand their social experiences in communities with high unemployment, with high drug use, high family breakdown. How did they understand? How did they frame their experience? And they couldn't do it. They just didn't have the intellectual resources to be able to frame and understand their own personal and social experiences. And what Kevin MacDonald is doing here is talking about this as that these life worlds of these kids are progressively disorganized in terms of their access to kind of coherent social norms, roles, and transmitted patterns of socialization. So we get here a really good example of this process of deinstitutionalization and the impact it's having on the individual life course and of the framing of the good. That poses, I think, a huge challenge for education. Indeed, I think in many ways, it's the fundamental moral challenge that educators have to deal with, have to confront. And it means that if we think about education in narrowly instrumental terms as preparation for the labour market, for example, I think we're doing young people an injustice. Our obligation as educators, as teachers, is to help young people frame and develop the capacities to lead a life that's useful, rewarding, and valuable to themselves and their communities. But the current organisation, our institutional arrangements, make that progressively more difficult and complex. So that, I think, ups the ante for educators, and it means that we have to attend to that issue all the way school, from kindergarten all the way through to year 12. These are some of the issues then that we have to address. Now, I think framing a good as a process is not about studying the canonical texts. That's a useful thing to do, but it's not sufficient. It's about having a broad experience of life and of different ways of life Amy Gutman talks about this as the principle of non-repression, that young people need to have access, both in theory and in practice, to different ways of life, what it is to be a carpenter, what it is to be a lawyer, what it is to think about to quantum physics, or to read an epic poem like Paradise Lost. So these are all issues that need to be taken into account in thinking about what it is to frame a good life. Howard Gardner, who's a well-known educational commentator, a professor at Harvard, one of the leading cognitive scientists of the last half century, wrote a book about 7 years ago called The Disciplined Mind, in which he said that there are three fundamental issues that education has to deal with. One is the realm of truth, the second is the realm of beauty, and the third is the area of the realm of morality. And that education is fundamentally concerned about developing an understanding of the broader themes of life, indeed with the question of why the world as it is and how life can and should be lived. And that's partly what, and in good part, what education is about. Preparing for the labour market, preparing for an occupational future is a part of that, but it's not the whole story. Okay, the third principle, design principle that I want to point to is one that is intellectually rich, coherent and rich. Now this is fairly straightforward and I'm not going to spend as much time of this on this issue as I have on the two previous ones. It has to have depth, it has to have breadth, it has to have connectivity. That is, kids need to understand the relationships of different kinds of knowledges, both theoretical and practical, to each other. And I'll talk more about that later. And it needs to cultivate understanding. And by that, I want to focus on conceptual understanding, because that's the key for understanding relationships in the world, to have concepts that give you a way of capturing process of what happens in the world and what's happened to your own life. It's about epistemic and cognitive agency. It's about application, about problem solving, about concept building, about interpretation, about explanation. It's not just about memorization. It's about meaning making. Jerome Bruner, in a really fascinating and whimsical book that he wrote 15 years ago, talked about his aspirations at the very beginning of the cognitive revolution in the 1950s. He was one of the founding fathers of cognitive science in America. And he said when they started out the cognitive revolution, what they had in mind was a focus on meaning making, and what they got was a focus on information processing. Well, not being a particularly good Christian, I'm going to not follow that maxim at all and going to suggest something quite different. The image of the tree of knowledge, of course, has been a very powerful one in Western culture. And there are numerous, the iconography of this is pervasive throughout our culture, and we can see many images of the story. This is from the early 14th century, and you can see again this kind of the image of the tree of knowledge, and again the tree of knowledge not only of kind of the world, but of the word and of good, the word of good of evil. This is another tree of knowledge that you might all be familiar with. It's a local tree of knowledge, now deceased, unfortunately. It was the foundation for those of you who were around for when the Labour Party, the first Labour Party meeting was held, quorum was held under this tree of knowledge in the outback in Queensland. This image, this metaphor, continues to pervade our culture in all sorts of interesting ways. This is a recent book on cognition, and you can see the metaphor being played out here. And of course, in the high-tech world, again, we can see the impact of this very powerful metaphor, and in the commercial world as well. This is a IT company in Melbourne that advertises using the tree of knowledge. So it's a really powerful image that runs right through our culture. So what am I going to do? I'm going to start with some general statements or design principles around curriculum design. And then I want to focus on a particular principle around the notion of disciplinarity. Now, I know you've had some discussions about that particularly. I know Peter, in his paper, raised that issue at some length, so I'm going to say some things about that. And then I'm going to talk about a particular model for a senior secondary syllabus that I've worked up. You know, given the kinds of constraints, the kind of issues that you have here in Queensland, and the kind of principles that you've indicated you wanted to adopt to frame the senior secondary syllabus. Then I want to finish off with some of the key implementation issues. I'm going to run through some of this fairly quickly, and some of it I'll spend more time on. The policy settings, you're all familiar with this. I'm not going to say much about it. I think these are very sensible principles. This is a very sensible proposal. I don't have any reservations at all about what the proposal one that the QSA has prepared. So I'm not going to say any more about that. I'm going to incorporate those principles in what I propose, and you'll see how I do that later on. There are certain kinds of assumptions and commitments that have been adopted as well that underpin the framework that QSA has adopted. And those two I'm going to simply accept as kind of parameters for the work that I'm going to suggest. The QSA framework has a clear rationale that you're all familiar with. It has a statement of key purposes that I'm going to say more about in a moment. And the first one focusing on the notion of the development of the whole person, and secondly upon post-school destinations broadly. From education, work, and adult life. Then the broad the design principles that have been mapped out, coherence, rigor, flexibility, and connectivity. I endorse all of these principles. I have no reservations about them. I think they're sensible, powerful, coherent, and they will help drive, I think, a good, sensible curriculum development process. So I don't want to say anything particularly about those at this point. Let me say something then about the design principles over and above the ones that you've already mapped out in the documentation that you've prepared. I want to make three preliminary points about these design principles or about design, the process of design, curriculum design more broadly. The first is that the curriculum design is a matter of practical judgment in both the Aristotelian and the Kantian sense. It's not simply, in particular, it's not simply a matter of epistemological determinism, that we've got a map of knowledge and we simply map the curriculum onto the map of knowledge. There was a paper, a very influential paper, that an English philosopher, Paul Hirst, prepared in the 1960s that was about forms of understanding that had a huge impact on British and Australian and to some extent American debates in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And that reflected that kind of assumption that the curriculum ought to be built upon the structure of knowledge. And you know, that's an important part, important element of the way we think about the curriculum, and we can see the echoes of that, the resonances in the way that we think about knowledge and the curriculum. So it's not to be repudiated, but I think we need to be careful that the curriculum is more than simply a mapping of epistemology, of the structure of knowledge as such. And indeed that there are a range of normative, empirical, policy and even political considerations that need to be taken into account. This makes the process, I think, complex. It's not an easy task. You've got to bring all of these considerations into play and find a resolution that's sensible, coherent and implementable. It also has to be principled. And I'm going to spend, in fact, some time talking about what those principles might be, because I think we can't simply have a dog's breakfast in the way, in the particular principles we put together. It has to be coherent and it has to be consistent with our most fundamental assumptions and commitments about the value and purpose and the organisation of education. And in pursuing that argument, I want to sort of draw your attention to a distinction that's familiar to, I'm sure, to you all, between things that are instrumentally valuable and things that are intrinsically valuable. And I think that comes up particularly in the statement of principle. There's also Gabriel Matters prepared a paper. I actually haven't seen the paper, but in Peter Freebody's paper, he quoted from that paper quite liberally and indicated these are a set of principles, design principles, that Gabriel had prepared for the QSA. I think this is, another very good set of principles, and I don't have any issues with with any of those principles. I think there are issues about, well, what are the priorities? I mean, what's more important? How do you resolve conflicts and tensions between them? But that's for another day. The ones that I want to focus on today to do with a curriculum that has to be purposeful, it has to be existentially meaningful and valuable, it has to be intellectually coherent and rich, it has to be institutionally relevant and valuable, it has to be socially inclusive, and it has to be principled. So those are the key issues that I want to talk about. Then I want to talk about the issue of disciplinarity in some detail, and then towards the end I want to talk about the proposal that I think you have in your package for the particular design that I would recommend for QSA to consider. Purposeful. Well, it's clear that I think QSA has indicated a strong commitment to a purposeful career, to a set of purposes that will guide curriculum development. And I think this is incredibly important because, and for a range of reasons. One is that if you don't have a clear set of purposes, what tends to happen is that subject matter takes over and you begin to organise the curriculum around subjects, around English and maths and history and the rest. And the broader purposes that you want education to serve, or organising it around pathways, the broader purposes that you want education to serve get lost. And I think it's important to keep this in mind. This is your starting point, your point of departure. And I've quoted this before, so I endorse, I think this is a very strong statement, a very sensible statement, and I don't have any reservations about it. However, I want to amplify it in a number of ways. And I want to amplify it with a little normative theory. I happen to have a background in both history and philosophy, so I sometimes, in working these issues, I draw on that background. And here I'm going to draw on some work from John Rawls and Charles Taylor, who are both, Rawls is now deceased, but was an extremely influential American political and moral philosopher for the last half century. Charles Taylor is still alive, he's a Canadian. And I'm going to draw on some of their work in the way I kind of unpack these issues.